Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the NICE Privacy and Security Tool webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you'd like to ask a question during the presentation, please use the chat feature located in the lower left corner of your screen. If at any time you need to reach an operator, please push star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, February the 16th, 2012. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Sharon Barry. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Health Homes Implementation Series second session, which is about the NICE Privacy and Security Toolkit, and I welcome everybody. Okay, just a little background about what we're going to be covering today. Here's the agenda, and first I'm going to introduce the New York eHealth Collaborative and the Regional Extension Center that I am part of. Then I'm going to go into some information about what is Health Homes. Then we're going to talk about privacy and security of protected health information, and that's really the backbone of this discussion, making sure that information is kept secure. What are the rules that went into that? And there's one that relates specifically called 42 CFR Part 2 that's behaviorally related. And then there are the others, which are HIPAA privacy and security rules and high tech. Then we're going to go into meaningful use objectives and what objectives does this relate to, and the risk mitigation process, and then the toolkit that actually helps you through that risk analysis and mitigation. And the tools are listed here. There are actually five of them. One of them is a subset of the other, and we'll be going through each of those tools. And then at the end, I have resources, which are links, so that you can take a look at some of the sites that I've discussed on this webinar. Okay, first, just to tell you a little bit about the New York eHealth Collaborative. We're a not-for-profit organization working to improve healthcare for all New Yorkers using health information technology. So there are three programs I'd like to let you know a little bit about. One of them is the Regional Extension Center. The Regional Extension Center assists with the promotion, adoption, and meaningful use of electronic health records. We educate the public about the benefits of using an EHR. We assist providers who do not have an EHR, help them select the one that works for them, and help them use it meaningfully so that they can qualify for reimbursement. We're now in the process of building the SHINE, which is the second program I'm talking about. And that is the State Health Information Network of New York, and that's a secure network for sharing electronic medical records across the state. One of the requirements of meaningful use is health information exchange, and through the SHINE that will be accomplished, and we are leading a multi-state initiative in that regard, and that will allow collaboration and care so that doctors can all work together as a team sharing information that's needed to make that happen. And then the last program is development of statewide policies in relation to HIT. So there we come up with what the state's policies should be. We bring stakeholders together and discuss what's on the table and build consensus. And in this regard, we collaborate with the New York State Department of Health. So what are health homes? Health homes came about based on the Affordable Care Act, and CMS had the concept, and it's in order to pursue three goals to improve health care. One of them is the experience of the care, second one would be health of populations, and the third is to reduce the per capita costs of health care. So it's a person-centered system of care for Medicaid beneficiaries that have multiple or severe chronic conditions to better coordinate and manage their services. So that's the idea, is have that person in the center, have coordination of care, have someone working with them so that their care is to the best benefit and the costs are minimized. So what are the capabilities required in a health home? So it should be quality-driven, cost-effective, and culturally appropriate for the person, and it should be family-centered health home services. So it's person and family-centered. there should be coordination and access to preventative and health promotion services. There should be a care plan developed for that individual so that it coordinates all their clinical and non-clinical services and supports to address their health-related needs. And here's a key element, which is HIT should be used to link services, facilitate communication between and among providers and individuals and caregivers, and provide feedback to practices. And the last point is there should be continuous quality improvement programs, and data should be collected and sent back so we can analyze the value of these programs. So one of the things mentioned on the prior slide was how HIT, Health Information Technology, is part of health homes. A study that I am referencing here just recently said that only 8% of all behavioral health providers have fully implemented electronic records. Now that's compared to the regular population of providers, which has 40% using EHRs at this point. So that's much lower, and I would even venture to say from what I've seen that those that are using EHRs are not necessarily finding them doing what they would like them to do. So there's a need to improve that area, and there's a need for more people to buy into using electronic health records in this arena. Now, if without that connectivity, behavioral health providers cannot communicate with the rest of the healthcare system. It's a very key piece to have there because we're treating patients as a whole, and behavioral health is one part of them. And also, there have been findings, of course, that those that have issues that are significant in the behavioral health field also typically have many other health issues. So if you're missing that piece from the health record, then you're missing the whole person again. So security policies and processes. If you had a patient that opened up the paper in the morning and took a look at it and saw this headline, that 7 CDs with patient data was lost at a mental health or medical center, do you think they'd be comfortable if later on they walked into your office and you asked them to sign a consent form to have their data released out on the electronic health record system? I don't think so. So we need to make sure to protect the information so breaches like this cannot happen. How can we do that? That's what I'm going to talk about today. So let's look at the timetable, the timeline for security policies that address protecting that information. The first one came about in the early 1970s, and it's called 42 CFR Part 2. And what it states is that a program may not disclose any information that identifies a patient as being in a drug or alcohol program or as having a drug or alcohol problem. So that was the early piece, and I'm going to go into that in a little while. Then came in 1996, the HIPAA rule first came about with required compliance in April 2003 that addressed protected health information, first mention of that. And then later on came the security rule in April of 2005, which enhanced the privacy rule. And then came HITECH most recently in 2009, which also tightened some of the aspects of the earlier rulings. I'm going to talk a little bit about them. So first, 42 CFR Part 2. That's the first health privacy law. Why did it come about? It was enacted because Congress felt that there was a stigma associated by patients feeling that they didn't want to report about their issues and enter treatment because others would find out their names and it could be a problem. They feared prosecution. So there was a ruling that passed that said that a program cannot disclose any information that identifies a patient as being in a drug or alcohol program or having a problem as such. And as I said, it was enacted in the early 70s, and it came about through SAMHSA, which is a name that you're probably familiar with, and it was to protect those patients so that they get the care that they need. Just so you know, that New York state law determines the rulings that relation to privacy of mental health patients and HIV and genetic and domestic violence. This one is talking about alcohol and drug abuse. That's a federal law. So the specifics in relation to mental health comes from New York State. Okay, so who is actually covered in this ruling? Who are these providers we're talking about? What's the program that's defined here? And what does that mean, federally assisted? So a program includes any person or organization that provides and holds itself out as providing alcohol or drug abuse diagnosis, treatment, or referral for treatment. So that's what the program definition is, and it has to be federally assisted, which means that it has either tax-exempt status or receives federal funding, or the government gave it licensing to conduct business in this regard, or it's an actual federal government or state or local government program. So in order to actually disclose information in this ruling, there's a need for written patient consent. Keep that in mind later on, because you'll see that in the privacy rule, written consent is not needed for certain disclosures. Here it is. So what is in that written consent? What has to actually be signed? And it has to state the program or person that's permitted to make the disclosure, the individual or organization to which the disclosure is to be made, including the name of the patient, and the purpose of the disclosure, and how much information is and what kind of information is to be disclosed, the signature of the patient or another authorized person, the date on which the consent is signed, and a revocation statement, meaning when can it be that it is subject to revocation at any time. And the last one is the expiration date or condition upon it will be revoked. So these are all the pieces that need to be in place in order for consent to be given. And here, just to let you know, this is a picture of the health information privacy information that's found on the SAMHSA website, which I had stated before. It's a federal services agency established in 1992, and they focus specifically on people that have mental and substance abuse disorders and how their lives can be improved. So right over here, you have lots of different pieces that you can take a look at. Next came the HIPAA privacy rule. And compliance to that rule was required in 2003. What was that about? The privacy rule protects all individually identifiable health information. So that's the information that we're trying to protect, held or transmitted by a covered entity or its business associate in any form or media. Notice the media is either electronic, paper, or oral. And that's called protected health information that it's protecting. As a function of this rule, there were requirements made that in offices where health information is used, that they need to specify privacy practices. There need to be HIPAA-compliant authorizations used there in order for disclosures that are outside of the usual realm. Policy and procedure manuals need to be put into effect. Business associates contracts, and I'll explain that in a minute. And these are all because of this ruling. And because of the earlier ruling, there were also consent policies that should be in place. Now, just to go over what the terminology is about. So what is protected health information? What is actually defined as that? And it has to do with an individual's past, present, or future physical or mental health or condition, so that kind of information, provision of health care to the individual, or the past, present, or future payment for the provision of health care to the individual. So these are the items that would be in that area, and it identifies the individual or can reasonably be used to identify the individual. So why is it saying that about identifying? Because if the data itself is de-identified, if it's been changed so that it's not recognizable or it cannot be put back to make it identifiable, then that is not considered PHI, and it can be used for analysis in that regard. So who is required to protect this information? The main requirement comes under the area of a covered entity. Now, who's a covered entity? Covered entity is any organization or corporation that directly handles that PHI, meaning personal health information, or personal health records. So what does that mean? It's a hospital, a doctor's office, a health plan, a healthcare provider, a healthcare clearinghouse. So those of you within the health homes would be within this area, of course. And then what is a business associate? So a business associate is someone who's doing business with a covered entity. So it's any organization or person working in association with or providing services to a covered entity who handles or discloses personal health information or personal health records, such as billing service, IT staff, transcription services. So those are people that are not necessarily the owners of that information, but they're using the information for to perform some kind of service or to assist those that have that information. So there are relationships between business associates and covered entities, and there are contracts between them, and that's where the responsibility of the business associates under the first privacy rule lie. Now, just to show what this protected health information looks like, it's a subset of the medical information. Not all of it is protected health information. If all the personal information, such as name, address, date of birth, social security number, if those are all de-identified, then the other information is not considered PHI. So how do these two rulings differ? What's different about them? And I think I alluded to it earlier, that under HIPAA, that they are able to disclose the information about an individual without patient consent if it's for purposes of treatment, payment, or healthcare operations. So that is allowed. Under 42 CFR Part 2, because of the extra level of confidentiality, written consent of a patient is required for most disclosures of information protected under Part 2, with some exceptions. So most of the time, there is consent needed, and again, it's to protect those patients so that their information is not exposed without their agreement. 42 CFR Part 2, as you see, is more stringent. So what's the consent process in theory for a health home? So it seems that in order to secure patient consent, when they enroll in the health home, they sign a consent form allowing for whatever information is needed to be shared with, for instance, a RIO, which would be a regional health information organization, which would be a repository for health information exchange. So when they enroll in the health home, they would sign, in theory, a consent form documenting their enrollment in the program. And this is a link to an example of the New York State consent form. I'm not sure if it's the current one, but it is an example to take a look at. If you'd like to identify more differences to compare the two rulings, CFR Part 2 and HIPAA Privacy, there are three documents out there that are very worth looking at. This is just a simple overview, but if you'd like to look more, this is where you find them. There's a link to one of them specifically, and you would find them on the SAMHSA Health Privacy section of their website. Next, we're going to look at the security rule, which came after the privacy rule. The difference here is that when looking at protected health information under the security rule, they are addressing only electronic, whereas the privacy rule was electronic and paper. And that is a big difference. Why would that be? I would imagine since in 2005 there was a lot more information available on the Internet, and there's a lot more health information in offices and in hospitals, so there was a need to make sure it's being protected correctly. So what were the safeguards as part of that ruling? There were physical safeguards that have to be taken into consideration, technical safeguards, and administrative safeguards. It's a three-prong approach. Physical has to do with building and equipment that would house the information, so that would be like an office. It would be like the server and all of the equipment that are used for housing the information, that using to access the information. And that would be all of those safeguards that could cause either intrusion or issues that could allow penetration of that data. And then the technical safeguards have to do with what technology can you put into place in order to protect the data, such as passwords should be created correctly, encryption of data so that if you have a piece of equipment that would be a physical piece, what can you do with technology to make it not usable, the data, so that if someone should access it, they would not be able to find out anything about that information. So these are technical safeguards, and administrative would be, what do you have in place at an office, at a hospital, at a site that would make sure that all those on board understand security requirements and have an officer in charge to make sure that those requirements are implemented and make sure that all risks are addressed as part of security rule. So these are the three areas that it touches. Now, this electronic protected health information is synonymous with protected health information. The only difference is that it's electronic in nature. So it's a subset of PHI. And again, it's all the information that is identifiable in relation to the patient. And under the security rule, this has been the addition to hone in on the electronic protected information. Next comes the high-tech rule. Now, what did the high-tech rule do differently? It came about in 2009, and it further strengthens HIPAA. It strengthens it in a number of ways. Some of the ways that it strengthens are there's now a federal security breach notification requirement, and that is if you're working for a site and you know that information has been compromised, you have a responsibility and a requirement to notify that that has taken place. Depending on the size of the breach, there are some extra requirements, which I'm going to go into a little bit later on, but there's a requirement of a notification that if compromise happened, you can't just say, oh, I made a mistake, I'll be more careful next time. Notification has to take place, so there's greater enforcement of protection of the information. There's also new rights of individuals. There's new restrictions on the use and disclosure of the PHI. There's also direct regulation of business associates who have now a greater responsibility under high-tech than they did under the earlier rules. I'll go into that a little bit on the next slides. So what are the new patient rights? A patient now under high-tech is entitled to a copy of their health record in electronic form, and the covered entities are required to give it to them. Also, the covered entities are required to account for all disclosures, so that would mean if someone has requested information about an individual, that individual can have a historical record of the last 3 years of who has made that request, so that they know who's inquiring after them. Also, covered entities may not share information with an individual's health plan for payment or health care operations if they've paid in full for the service, so they cannot report back. So that's an extra protection for the individual. These requirements were not in place before high-tech. Now, what are the changes to business associates? Now, remember, business associates are those that do business with covered entities but are not necessarily the owners of the health information. They are now subject to more careful, actually, they're required to follow the HIPAA privacy and security requirements in the same manner as covered entities. It used to be that they only had been obligated to comply with privacy rules to the extent required in their contracts with covered entities. So whatever was spelled out there, that's what they were required to do. Now they have the same responsibilities of keeping information secure as covered entities do. And covered entities may actually now be liable for the actions of their business associates in limited settings. So if they don't do what they're supposed to do, the covered entities may also be liable for the results. Another addition is that RIOs and HIEs, which are health information exchange repositories, are now also treated as business associates, which means that they are required to also follow privacy and security rules as it relates to electronic protected health information. So as you see here with high-tech, I mentioned again that RIOs and HIEs are to be treated as business associates, and they must comply. Now, this National Security Breach Notification Law, what is that about? If there's a breach of unsecured health information, I said it earlier, notification needs to happen. And there's greater enforcement, and it's performed by the State Attorney General. If it's de-identified, that's not an issue. You still should be more careful next time, but it's the actual identifiable data that is considered a breach. And there can be civil penalties or criminal penalties for breaches. Now we're going to go segue into what this toolkit that I'm going to be showing you about is, and it has to do with Meaningful Use Core Measure 15, which is risk analysis. Meaningful use, for those of you who are not familiar with this, of an EHR is a program that's taking place now, and it was issued by CMS. It's a Medicare and Medicaid EHR incentive program providing a financial reward to eligible professionals for the meaningful use of certified EHRs to achieve health and efficiency goals. So for those providers that are in the Medicare or Medicaid bucket, and there are specific requirements there, those that are eligible are able to receive those incentives. But how do they show meaningful use of their certified EHRs? There are specific criteria that are used to identify that they have satisfied those criteria, and there are 15 core objectives that need to be satisfied, all 15, not most, but all. And then there's menu objectives. So there's 10, of which 5 can be selected. Two of them have to do with public health issues, and one of those, out of those two, has to be one of the 5 selected. Right now, we're in the midst of stage 1 meaningful use. There will be 3 stages in total over a 5-year period. Stage 2 meaningful use is imminent. It might come out. I just read an article that it might be out next week. Anyway, it should be within the next few weeks, probably, which will be a little bit. Not a little bit, but it'll be more stringent than stage 1. So here is the requirement that we are going to now take a look at, and that is it's meaningful use core set number 15, protect electronic health information. So until now we've been talking about the rulings that have been created to secure health information. Now how can you actually put into place the steps needed to make this happen at your site, at your institution? So this is the objective that's needed to be met, and it's called Protect Electronic Health Information Created or Maintained by the Certified EHR Technology Through the Implementation of Appropriate Technical Capabilities. The measure that you need to meet is to conduct or review a security risk analysis as per, and that 45 CFR 164.308A1 is the final rule that determined what the requirements were, and implement security updates as necessary and correct identified security deficiencies as part of the management process. So this is it. This is where it says security risk analysis needs to be done. Where does this come from? Remember a little earlier we showed the security rule that it had an administrative section. In that administrative section, it's also defined risk analysis that need to conduct an accurate and thorough assessment of the potential risks and vulnerabilities to the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of electronic protected health information held by the covered entity. And then it's not only analyzing it, it's risk management, which is the next step, which is once you implement security measures sufficient to reduce risks and vulnerabilities to a reasonable and appropriate level to comply with the rule. So it's identifying the risks and then managing the risks. And it's not a one-time thing. Once you analyze where the risks are and you put into place a risk mitigation program, it's ongoing because there are always new things added to your practice, whether it's new software, new people join the team. It's a constant keeping up with making sure that risks are being minimized and managed. As you see in this graphic, meaningful use, as we just identified, it's a part of the security rule. But it's all HIPAA. It comprises all of these standards. So how do we make this happen in your health home? These are the steps for risk mitigation. You need to train your participants, whoever is going to help with implementation, or those that just need to understand privacy and security. So there are tools to effectively protect the confidentiality of health information. So what are the next 5 steps? The practice needs to be informed about the privacy and security and risk mitigation requirements for meeting meaningful use objectives. The implementation team, that would be a team at your site or together perhaps with an agent or an assistant that can help you with this, someone that's versed in this or someone on your team that might have security knowledge. They'll conduct a privacy and security assessment using tools that I'm providing or additional tools depending on what you see fit during the implementation stage in order to identify security-related issues that need to be addressed by the practice. Then there's a risk analysis step to determine the current risks and a risk mitigation strategy to mitigate them. Documentation needs to be updated, and that part is about having a policies and procedures manual in place so that everyone there is on board about what is required at this practice and what the rules are. And then the staff needs to be trained and educated, which is a constant process too, and it's education about the culture. So just said, security culture. How do you establish a security culture? There are some things that are very easy to educate people on, such as strong passwords, antivirus software needs to be up to date, a firewall needs to be in place. People should know what these things are. Controlling access to protected health information, they should understand that that's a need, that physical access to the network should not be allowed. They shouldn't be just allowed to download anything to the network. Everything has to be secure. Limit network access, plan for the unexpected. Good computer habits, mobile devices should be protected. That's especially true. It's always true, but now there's more and more mobile devices being used. So you need to train your workforce and establish policies and procedures. Now, I stated earlier that part of high tech, one piece that's very key with this new ruling, is enforcement. And the enforcement is done by OCR, which is the Office for Civil Rights. It's an excellent website to take a look at. They have some excellent materials about this subject, and they are there to enforce, to make sure that everything is being done as it should be. Breaches are being discussed. They're being publicized in the news and the newspapers, and it makes it sound as if there's so many issues happening, and hopefully they will lessen as time goes on. Under high tech, notification after a breach is required, as I said earlier. There have been already over 500 breaches with 7.8 million patients affected, but hopefully that will lessen with time as everyone does their job to protect the health information. I expect that those numbers will go down because that's the goal. But the causes that have been found to be most common in terms of breaches have been theft, or loss, or unintentional unauthorized access to data, or human error, and improper disclosure of information. So these are the common causes. So I know recently there's been a lot of discussion about hacking into data, not health data, but in general. This does not seem to be a major cause in this regard. It's really, these are preventable issues, because theft, if the theft is with data that has been protected, that has been no longer recognizable, then that could protect that from being a breach, an issue. So these are all things that if there's education, then hopefully we'll be able to mitigate these issues. Again, having to do with enforcement, high tech has given the power to OCR to do audits to make sure, you know, here we have these concepts, these ideas of how to mitigate risk. Is this doing the trick? Are people really taking this seriously? When they attest that their data is secure, is it really secure? So OCR has now been created a contract with KPMG, a consulting firm, to do 150 random audits of covered entities and business associates between November of 2011, so it started a couple of months ago, and it's going on for the next year. So they're going to, you know, it's not to catch sites, but instead to see, are they doing things the right way? So the purpose is to ensure compliance, and yet to see if there are holes and if there are gaps, and how can we make this even better? We can always improve. So now, we're going to talk a little bit about this toolkit in a few minutes. I have a couple more slides until I start really delving into that. And I think I'm going to stop for some questions in between. So if you have a question, you might as well type it in right now. Privacy and Security Toolkit, what's the scope of that? Now, it's intended really for guidance in order to educate you guys as stakeholders about the privacy, security, and risk mitigation guidelines to be followed at provider practices. It's to increase your awareness. You'll see there's different parts to it. Some of them are more basic. Some of them are more complex and more dig deeper into the subject, and I'll show you that in a few minutes. But it's to give you an idea of where to look in order to understand how you can make this satisfy this requirement. And the goal is implementation of appropriate technical capabilities and protective measures to reduce risk to an acceptable level. That's what we're trying to do, reduce risk. And just to give you an idea of what the steps are that you should take when you're going through a risk analysis. There's two phases. Phase one is identifying where you are. What's the inventory of items at your site? What are you using? What hardware? What's the system characterization? What software? What system interfaces? What data? What information? What people are using it? What's the mission? And that's characterizing your system, because if you understand where it all fits together, then you can more easily identify where the risks are, where the threats are, and where the vulnerabilities are. So step one is that. Step two is then in those system items that you have there, what are the possible threats that exist? Are there ones that you know about that are specific, that are being announced through the media, or are you just... Do you already take into consideration the need to protect those pieces because you have a firewall? Do you not? What are the different items that could be considered a threat? Then there's vulnerability identification, and that's what weaknesses do you have? What items have you not thought about? Are there any audits that you've done where you've come up with weaknesses that have not necessarily been addressed or that have been addressed? What are the requirements to make your place secure? And then control analysis is what controls can you put into place? What do you have in place and what can you add to the controls that you have in place? And this is phase two. So once you've gone and decided what controls are needed in order to help make your place have the least risk that it can, then you need to talk about, okay, those risks, what are they? Like, which ones, how can I prioritize them? Well, one way you can prioritize them is likelihood of those risks occurring, the likelihood of that threat really happening, the nature of the vulnerability, what controls are there to mitigate that happening. Then the impact, if something were to occur, how much of an impact will it have on your business, on your practice? How critical is the data that would be impacted? Do you have an alternative method to recover that data? What is the impact? Then risk determination is putting those things together, the impact, the likelihood, and the threats, put it all together, and you figure out what the risks are and what the controls should be and the results. And I'll go into that a little bit more in my next few slides. So control recommendations. Once you've come up with those controls, arrange them in order of risk. Try to address the ones that can be addressed either because they're highest threatening first or because they are easy to knock off. They're not difficult to do. So so you might want to prioritize them depending on what you see makes sense for you. But the highest risk items can be considered first, but if you have little things that you can, again, address easily, you can do that too. Don't neglect, though, the operational impact. You know, something that's working now but yet has high risk should definitely be addressed because until it doesn't work, you don't realize it. Now we're going to switch over to the discussion of the specific items in the Privacy and Security Toolkit, but I think I'm going to take a little stop here. And Jacqueline, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Great. Have been any questions that have come through?
There have been a couple. So just some ground rules here. So all the questions that are submitted via the chat, we'll do the best we can to address them. If not, all questions will be submitted to State Medicaid and OHIT for answers, and they would be included in the FAQ, which is located on the Medicaid website. So the call is being recorded. The recording and the presentation will be made available on the Medicaid website. If you log on to the Medicaid website and select Health Homes, there's a section for partner resources. In that section, I believe the very first item in that section refers to implementation of Health Homes HIT adoption training webinars. That's the location where all of the data for this webinar series will be available. The tools that correspond with the specific webinar sessions are available on the NICE website. If you log on to www.nyehealth.org, in the resources section, there's an area for tools. You press tools, and all the tools will be available to you. Okay, so there were a couple of questions that came in, kind of lengthy, Sharon, so give me 2 seconds to go back to the top. Okay, a question came in with regard to whether or not the consent rules that you spoke to are included or have been acknowledged in the documentation that has been presented for the health home. If you log onto the Medicaid website and you click Forms, there is a health home patient information sharing consent form. And the second page of that forms, I believe all the legislation relevant to this initiative, as mentioned by Sharon, has been documented at number bullet 3 in page 2. And this form and the rules have also been reviewed by DOH, OMH, and OASIS. So I think we have the appropriate folks looking at that to ensure that they are compliant with that form there. Sharon, I mentioned that the tools will be located on the NICE website. Are you going to walk through specifically which tools are included and what the pieces are during the rest of this presentation?
You bet.
Perfect. So we covered that question. Okay. I will read this other one, and we'll see if we can answer that. So, Sharon, all of the language is provider in this presentation, focused, but health homes will build Medicaid and Medicaid-funded services and maintain confidentiality, patient information in the same way a physician does, but CBOs are not included in this. And I think, Sharon, I don't want to step on your toes, but I want to level set that we're benchmarking from the Privacy and Security Toolkit that's used at the Regional Extension Center, and the primary focus of that is primary care. So, Sharon, I don't know if you have anything to add to that about the CBOs and why the nomenclature in the presentation is primary care-centric above and beyond that.
That's exactly right. We're dealing with providers, and it is primary care providers that we're working with, and I would imagine there should be extra pieces added to this toolkit that will specifically address those in the behavioral health realm that are not included.
Okay. Another question came in about the health home consent. Health home data held by a RIO may be a subset of the RIO data. Is consent needed by the health home consumer to release PHI to the RIO? And I believe the answer to that is that the health home consent is really a consent to both disclose and view. So if you haven't had the opportunity to take a look at that form, please do so. And if there are specific questions, I'm quite sure the folks at DOH can provide additional contents there. And then lastly, someone is looking for the URL for the Medicaid website. What we'll do is we'll make sure that information is published with the slide deck, and shoot that out to all the health home applicants, and hopefully that gets trickled down through all the ranks here.
I actually believe I have that as one of my last slides, our link to
even
all
better.
The resources.
Perfect. So it should be included in the presentation when you guys get it. Okay, Sharon, I don't think there are any other questions that we're not going to address at the moment, and if we did not address those effectively, we'll make sure those get to Medicaid and OHIT for answering for you guys. Sharon, you want
Thank
to continue?
You. Yeah, thank you, Jacqueline. Okay, now I'm going to give a little talk about that toolkit that we alluded to earlier. This toolkit has tools to address core measure 15, which we said, and conduct a risk analysis at a medical practice. These are the pieces. There's the cybersecurity guide, and that's a short piece, and it was created by the ONC. About a 10-page guide, and it's very good to read before you go into some of the other pieces. I'll discuss it a little bit more in a minute. The NICE Meaningful Use Fact Sheet is a 2-pager, and that's also very good for anyone in a practice to read to understand what this is all about. Then comes the privacy and security training for the practice, which are slides, and there's about 60 slides, and it's a great education for practice members to see so that they understand, again, where this is coming from. Then there's the security risk assessment questionnaire, and that's to be done by the person or people that are actually analyzing to make sure that the risks are being addressed correctly at the practice. That questionnaire was developed by ONC. And so it was created by the organization that's making sure that we are compliant. So it's a good place to start to make sure you're addressing all the pieces. And then the RECT update version is there's an organization of a collaborative space where all the regional extension centers, each state has about one. There's about 62 in the country where they get together to share common practices. And they work on tools and toolkits, and some of the pieces here have come from there. And they have taken this risk assessment questionnaire and made it a little bit more user-friendly, added some pieces to it so it has the same foundation but some additional updates. And I'll show you some of them at the place where I introduce it. Then there's an information security policy manual, and that's a key piece. We talked about it earlier that the policies and procedures at a site need to be spelled out so that everyone on board understands how to keep the information secure. Now, just notice the note on the bottom, which I alluded to earlier also, and that is that behavioral health, privacy, and security requirements that exceed those for medical practice are not included in the toolkit. This was developed for a regular practice, but there will be enhancements, I'm sure, made later on because of its importance. So here comes the first piece, which is called the Cybersecurity Guide, 10 Best Practices for the Small Healthcare Environment, developed by the ONC. And it's a first take. It's a good place to start to read about requirements. It's very easy to work with. I'll tell you a little bit more in a second. This is what it looks like. I always think it's good to show a visual if you can. So here, this is what the piece looks like, and it has in it some interesting information, and it includes best practices, the 10 best practices. It's good when you can enumerate that as such. So the 10 best practices highlighted, and each one is gone into in a little bit of detail. So it's, for instance, use strong passwords, install and maintain antivirus software, use a firewall, and they're all explained. Control access to protected health information, control physical access, limit network access, plan for the unexpected, maintain good computer habits, protect mobile devices, and establish a security culture. So these are the ones that are recommended as the top 10. And then after that, there is a checklist at the end of the guide that identifies important basic security practices. So these are the items that it goes into. Passwords, what to do to make passwords strong. How to make sure your antivirus is doing what it should. Why is firewall access so important? How do you control physical access? How do you control network access? Backup and recovery, maintenance, mobile devices. And as an example, here's the cybersecurity guide here's one of the sample checklists. So the one on passwords, just to show you an example, what's included there are that you need to check these off. Do you have policies in place prescribing password practices for the organization? So does everybody understand that? That would be something in your manual. Does all staff understand and agree to abide by password policies? So perhaps in your manual, which I think we have in there, that template that we have here, there's a form that your staff member would sign off and say, yes, I understand all of these policies within this booklet. Does each staff member have a unique username and password? That means no sharing. If you share, then you don't know who actually did something. Passwords are not revealed or shared with others. Passwords are not written down or displayed on the screen. Passwords are hard to guess but easy to remember. They're changed routinely. They're not reused. Default passwords are changed during installation. Devices that allow optional password protection is turned on so that you are having password protection. So these are the items that you can include. And these are what you need to know when you're talking about passwords. And then over here on the bottom it says strong passwords should be at least 8 characters in length. Make sure of that. Now I'm teaching you something you might not know, but that's a good thing to do. And include a combination of uppercase and lowercase letters. Why? Because it's harder to figure out when it's a case-sensitive password, when there's much more to go through in terms of probability of guessing a password. And there are password cracking software out there. At least one number should be included and one special character. The more variability, the better. Include a punctuation mark. Change them often, at least quarterly. So these are the recommendations. A lot of these things should be built into your software, but yet know that they should be followed. This is the two-pager that just goes into what is privacy and security in relation to meaningful use, and it's a very good starting point as well for you to introduce to all the people in the office and to understand what we're talking about. What are the types of things on there? Questions like, meaningful use is all about helping patients. What does privacy and security have to do with it? So the answer is there. Are there any privacy or security requirements for complying with meaningful use in order to receive incentive money? So the answer will be there too, and the answer is yes, there are requirements. How can I meet the objective of protecting electronic protected health information under the Meaningful Use Incentive Program? So it'll talk about the risk analysis and mitigation program. And then it says my EHR vendor is certified by using a certified system. Will I meet the Meaningful Use security objectives? Absolutely not. You can have a list of what they are, but you have to put them into play. Next is the security training for the practice. That's a PowerPoint presentation. And it talks about security awareness. It's everything you need to know about security. And the staff at the practice should all view this training presentation, and I recommend it. It does not include information about behavioral and mental health confidentiality rules, but that can be added. Next comes the risk assessment questionnaire. Now, this was put out by ONC, and I said earlier, and it's the centerpiece. This is really where the risk analysis takes place using this spreadsheet, and it was released in early 2011 to address the meaningful use core measure for the assessment of security risk and includes suggested additions, as I said, put out by the REC group. And it's a four-step process, and it enables you to identify and mitigate risks against pre-identified threats and vulnerabilities. So it's a questionnaire, but it's actually an Excel spreadsheet, and that tool is a starting point for identifying the risks to the organization, to identify the level of risks against the threats and vulnerabilities, and it comes from standards that were put out by NIST, which is an organization that works together with the government. It's actually a branch of it. And there are publications that came out before that were pulled from in order to put together this spreadsheet. and there's a link to where to find them. So there are 7 tabs in this 4-step spreadsheet. The first tab is just instructional, tells you how to complete the forms. The second tab introduces where this comes from, how the guidance for risk analysis that comes from a publication called 9 Primary Risk Assessment Steps that was put out by NIST. The third tab is an inventory. Remember a couple of slides back when we talked about how you go about this process? First, you have to identify where you are, who is using your technology, and what technology do you have in place. That's the inventory. The fourth tab includes security issues that are addressed and screening questions for the practice. So that's questions and answers. One piece of it is pushed forward to the next tab, and it's to identify what you should be doing and what are you doing and are you doing it correctly, and I'll show you in a little bit what that looks like. The fifth and sixth tabs discuss people and processes and technology. So those are the two inventory-related aspects of your organization. Who are those people? What are those processes? And what is that technology that's working with electronic protected health information? And the control measures at the practice that can secure the data, the health information at the practice, and the likelihood and impact of risk exposure. That's where it is identified. That's the crux of this questionnaire, steps 5 and 6. It is a macro-driven spreadsheet. So when you start it up, it asks, do you want to enable the macros? And you answer yes. And then anything you put in each of these tabs, each of these sheets of the whole spreadsheet will then migrate from one tab to the next. The last tab is the takeaway, where you actually have the accumulation of all the high and medium risk findings and remediation from the prior tabs. That's your takeaway, that is your list of risks, and that's what you need to address. So here's the first tab, which shows you how to complete the forms. You probably don't need that much after the first time you look at it. Tab 2, as I said, goes into where the information comes from and how this assessment was created. Then we have the third tab, which is the inventorying of assets. It explains to you how to identify what your people and processes are and what your technologies are, such as fax machines, desktop PCs, scanners, cell phones, anything that could have a connection with protected health information at your practice. And you need to write them down, and it would be not only one computer, but all 6 computers at your office, so each one of them is addressed independently. And it would be not only one copy machine, but 2 copy machines where you could be copying that information. Not only one jump drive, but as many as you use. Then comes the step called screening questions. Here, this is a place where you identify the threat and vulnerabilities that are associated with your practice and whether you're addressing the threats. So the way it works is there's a topic. So for here, the first one, the topic is a security program and the roles and responsibilities. So there's questions that have to do with that. Has your organization formally appointed a central point of contact for security coordination that is needed? So they're saying, have you done that? And if so, who is that? And if there has not been one, have security responsibilities been assigned to multiple people? So your answer would go under response, and there would be that response would be, it's actually a pull-down. You can select yes, no, or addressed, partly addressed, or not addressed. I think those are the 3 options. And then the threat vulnerability statement is like, what would be the threat around that if you don't address it? So that would be management has not defined responsibilities for the information security program. So that's the threat. And then here you would write under notes and comments, what are your comments about that? Like what's going on in your practice that would lead you to where you are today or what you need to do? Next comes tabs 5 and 6. So tabs 5 and 6 are, like I said, the crux of it. So here, for instance, it goes into some of the same answers, the same questions that were in the screening questions, but the screening questions are more like matter-of-fact question and answers. Here, it's a little bit more, you'll see what I mean. So under the business asset, what is the item that we're addressing here? It's the security program. What is the threat vulnerability statement? Management has not defined responsibilities. That came from it's the same as the slide before. Recommended control measures. All information, security responsibility are clearly documented. This is what they would like you to have in place. This is to ensure timely, safe, and effective handling of all situations. Administrative user accounts, including additions, deletions, and modifications. So the existing control is what you have in place. You enter the answer here. Do you have this defined? Is it working in your practice? Is it effective? Then you select from a pull-down of the amount of effectiveness. Exposure potential comes here. You select it from a pull-down. Select the likelihood. What do you think the likelihood of this being an issue at your business, at your firm, at your practice? What would the impact be? Is it a high impact, a medium impact, or a low impact? Then these two together, likelihood and impact, join together, and the spreadsheet calculates the risk rating, whether it's a low risk, a medium risk, or a high risk. And that's for each item. I think there's 125 items on this spreadsheet that you look at, and this is how you calculate whether the items that need to be addressed are being addressed at the practice. And this is showing what you need to fill in, which I just went over. Then that spreadsheet that goes into people and processes and technology is then pulled into the last piece, which is your takeaway. And here, as you see, it calculates the number of risks that have been found that are high and the number that are medium and the number together. And then it lists them by which of those items have been found, and this can be printed out. And then you can address these and figure out what do we need to do to control these risks. What steps need to be taken to make these steps mitigated? What is our plan? So again, risks found, risk rating, and these are pulled from the slide from the tab before, the controls applied, and the recommended control measures. And then what is it that you're going to do? So this is the actual risk results. On the REC update, I said to you earlier that the RECs tried to make it a better, more user-friendly spreadsheet. They added a tab in the beginning so that you can identify the name of the practice, the name of your site, and all the information around it so that you have everything in one place. And then another very useful piece is that instead of just recommended control measures and comments, they say, put an owner on the item that needs to be addressed and put a target date on when it will be addressed by so that those steps will have a concrete resolution. I think that's a good idea. Okay, the last piece of the toolkit is the Information Security Policy Manual for the practice. Some people start by reading this manual and seeing what is it, what should an end product look like? It's a template, but what are the issues that should be addressed? What should it look like when I'm done? Some of the people that I work with start with this and then they go to some of the other pieces, but it depends on how you're comfortable. You can always read through it and then decide. So this is a list of all the safeguards that a practice might have in place, and it's a template for you to modify it for your site, for your location. And there should be copies of the manual made available, perhaps one for each member of the staff. Maybe it could be a copy that's on the computer and only one printed out, whatever you decide to do. But each of the staff members should be familiarized with what the rules and regulations are at the practice. This is what it looks like. It's an information security policy manual, and each item has its own policy and procedures page identifying what the requirements are, and they can be modified. And there's actually an instruction booklet to go with it, so you know what it is you need to revise with the information about that practice, so it becomes personalized. These are the items that are found within. Introduction, which just defines it. Employee responsibilities at a practice. Identification and authentication. That would have to be with IDs, passwords. Network connectivity. What are the rules in relation to that? What about malicious code? How can that be avoided? Encryption of data. Building security rules. Telecommuting rules. Protocols and devices for protocols for devices, retention, destruction of paper documents, how is that taken care of, disposal of external media and hardware, emergency operations procedure, break the glass procedures, which has to do with if someone is not allowed to be accessed by a person on the system and they do access it, how does it record that that took place? Sanction policies, e-discovery policies, breach notification procedures, network access requests. So then there's some forms that should be filled out by people at the office, confidentiality form, approved software, approved vendors, and a breach assessment tool. So these are the items that are included. There might be some updates to it in the most recent one that I sent that we're including with this. So it's a good place to start in terms of understanding what are some of the items you could put your hands on that need to be addressed to keep information secure. So we at NICE are happy to present this toolkit to you as guidance for what you need to do in order to address risk at your organization. And these are the guidelines for that. I'd like to thank Katie O'Neill. She was someone I consulted with for some answers, and I appreciate that. Here are some of the resources, some of the websites to take a look at to find more information about these subjects. And just to let you know that this is guidance, again, NICE has provided the information to guide practices in Medicaid health homes through the process of complying with through meaningful use and HIPAA and security rules. Use of the toolkit is meant to increase awareness of recommended safeguards and to alert providers to potential deficiencies in the management and protection of electronic health information. Conformity with the practices outlined in the materials does not guarantee compliance with any particular component of HIPAA or meaningful use and should not be considered legal advice. Use of the toolkit does not ensure a provider's compliance with applicable federal and state laws. Providers should consult an attorney for individualized legal advice on adherence to such laws. But it is a good set of tools. And now, the next session in the Health Homes Implementation Series will be Session 3, called Optimizing the Practice Workflow. And Dr. Alan Silver, the medical director of iPro, will be presenting together with Jacqueline Brinson, the program manager at NICE. That will be on Wednesday, March 7th at 2:30. And there's a link right here if you'd like to participate. And the training sessions, recordings, and registrations will all be made available on the Medicaid website. The link for that is there as well. And there's one more, and that is the session that follows is going to be EHR 101, presented by Denise Riley, Executive Director of eHealth Network of Long Island. And the date and time for that is Thursday, March 8th, 2012 at 10 a.m., and the registration link for that is here as well. I hope you enjoyed this presentation and found it useful. If there are any questions, please put them in the chat, and we'll be happy to address them now. Okay, let's take a look. Jacqueline, are there any questions?
At the moment, there aren't any new questions that I don't think we've addressed. Okay. So in terms of the webinar sessions, we are benchmarking from the experience of the Regional Extension Center to provide topics that were very strategically instrumental for the primary care providers to get through to their end target, which is meaningful use. And we're leaning on these particular early sessions to figure out what additional sessions will need to be held. So, Sharon, can you just go back one slide if you don't mind? Sessions 3 and 4, the third one is March 7th. That is going to talk specifically about workflow redesign and the little flavor of how you can take the mantra, the framework for doing that in a primary care office and apply that to your network as a health home. There are things you need to document. There are methods for communicating those types of changes. And those types of best practices are probably applicable across the board. So we'll be conducting that workflow session on March 7th. The March 8th session on EHR 101 is in direct response to the feedback we received via the chat and questions from the very first session we did on vendor selection. We had questions ranging from care management, more sophisticated RIO, HIE connectivity questions, as well as folks who still need to understand what a RIO is, what an EHR is, what a certified EHR means, what's the difference between modular versus complete. So I ask that you guys continue to put your questions in the chat, and at the end of this session, there is a survey. If there are topics that you need us to cover, we can definitely find those resources and bring them to you, but we need to know exactly what those topics should be. So I think we've given some time for folks to start to key into the chat, Sharon. Okay, so the webinar on 3-7, again, that's workflow redesign, and that should be located as well as on the Medicaid website with the registration information. Okay. So, Sharon, on the tools. So on the tool site, we only have PDF versions of the manual. Can you have that in Word? So can we make the Word version available to folks who want to use that as a template, the policy manual?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's a good idea.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and any of the documents that should be interactive, a Word or Excel document, we'll have them placed up there in those formats. So give us a couple of days to get that changed out. Great question. So Sharon, just from your experience with folks using the toolkit, how long does it take a practice or organization to effectively go through that? What has been your experience with working with the extension agents to do that?
It depends on the size of the practice, but I would feel comfortable to say that it could be accomplished not in one visit, but in two visits, one short visit, maybe 2 hours to just put it all on the table and have the practice understand the requirements, and then a second visit of maybe 4 hours. So let's say that's six hours or so, more or less, depending on experience to an extent. So someone that hasn't ever done it before might take longer.
So that would be per site, so each location about a day's worth of activity to do an effective risk assessment.
Yes, yes. It's one of the more complex requirements of meaningful use that is most time-consuming for a good reason.
So, Sharon, I do not see any other questions in the chat here. So again, the sessions will be made available, the audio as well as the PowerPoint slides on the Medicaid website. If you log on to the Medicaid website, there's a section for Health Home. In the Health Home section of the site, there's a section for partner resources, and the implementation series is listed at the top. So it's been brought to our attention that the slides from the last session and the audio is not there. We'll make sure those get up there, as well as each session on a go-forward. The tools can be found on the New York eHealth Collaborative website by logging on to www.nyehealth.org, select resources, then tools, and then all the tools available to the Regional Extension Center have been made available to the general public. So please feel free to thumb through those and ask any questions that you have using the contact information on the NICE Rec website, and then I know Sharon's provided her information a little earlier in this presentation. So we're more than willing and able to provide assistance if we can.
So
So it doesn't look like there are any more questions. So I guess it's time to say thank you very much for your attendance and time today, and we look forward to seeing you on March 7th in the Optimizing Practice Workflow session.
Thanks. I hope you guys found this interesting and useful, and any questions, send them along.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation, and please ask that you disconnect your lines.